This is going to be mostly about the sort of broad theory and ways of thinking about neutrino. I was going to begin by saying that I had voided all neutrinos from this talk, and then I did something I haven't done for about 2 weeks, and that's used the wrong particle name. Photon transport, which is why it's in the title. In the supernova. So 3 points of view. So let's see how we work this. Okay, the first thing, just a quick review of some of the things that we've heard in the last couple of weeks about the differences between supernovae and stars. Of course, in many ways, a supernova is a star. This is a stellar atmosphere's problem in its essence. The densities are very, very, very low. Only nebulae are lower, frankly. You have this rapid expansion, and the expansion is homologous, and that really sets a lot of the behavior. So because of the homologous expansion, we can think of it as being sort of like a Hubble expansion. Everywhere you look from within the fluid, distance is proportional to time and velocity. So it's r distance is r time v times t. For type 1 supernovae, there is a lack of the bound-free and free-free continuum processes, particularly in hydrogen and helium, that set the continuum flux levels and do a lot of the thermalization in ordinary stars and also in type 2 supernovae. And this means that there's a lot of disconnect between the apparent thermal structure and the gas, and the radiation gas. This can cause a lot of problems numerically in terms of trying to converge a model when you have very little to connect the temperature to the radiation field. So electron scattering and lines dominate, and I'll show you how it is that lines become so important in a moment. And the total optical depth is very low, so you don't have anything like a true photosphere where you can assume a black body at the bottom. You can make some approximations, but you have to be very careful about that, and you can see this in some of the synthetic spectra. So supernovae get their power from three sources. They can get it from shock heating of the envelope, a thermal source. You need an envelope to do this. You do circumstellar shock heating. This is type 2N, basically, and radioactivity, the deposition of nickel 56. And there's supposed to be a gamma there. I couldn't figure out how to make a gamma. I don't know why. So the gamma rays that come from the decay of the nickel 56 scatter off of electrons. And when they do so, they accelerate the electrons to non-thermal velocities. And these electrons distribute the energy locally after that scattering event. This not only heats the gas, but it provides a source of excitation and ionization, which is sort of beyond the thermal in a very non-thermal fashion.
Would you like making comments on acoustic power?
Acoustic power? What's acoustic power?
Shake the neutron star a little bit and see if you can get it to explode via acoustic mechanisms.
I'm not stepping into that one.
Adam Burr is channeling.
We can get a connection to Aspen. It's almost a discussion from there.
Edit this out. No. That has nothing to do with the supernova as an observable object. That's about the mechanism, and we'll set that aside for mechanism and core collapse.
When you talk about thermal, you include recombination.
Yes, that's of course one of the thermal sources of energy. The homology, as I think the next slide is, okay, we're moving to the blackboard. The homology is very important, and it's a very good approximation, and without it, basically, we're hosed. So I'm going to move to the blackboard, turn the light on. Yeah, I found it there a moment ago.
Do you want to just work with that piece, or should we move
this up? I might move it up later. We'll see how much. So there's sort of 3 points of view that I want to talk about. The first one I'm going to talk about, transport from the point of view of a photon. Actually, maybe let's put this up. You can let it
show. Maybe you can just shield that. Cover it.
Yeah, just no.
It's transparent.
There you go.
Yes, something optically thick, as Frank said. So, from the photon point of view, we're going to think like a photon for a few minutes. And so imagine that we're a photon, that we've just been emitted from some piece of fluid, and right now we don't care how. As we look around in the gas, again, because of homology, we see that everything is moving away from us. So all of the fluid elements are redshifted. And even though real photons can't look ahead and see what's about to happen, as we're imagining this, we can. And so what we see ahead of us are deep, opaque barriers in concentric spheres. And these are the resonance lines. So, and they're, you know, given by distances. So we could put down one little, you know. So at some velocity distance, delta V away, and I hope I don't have the sign of this backwards, you'll find some shift in the wavelength relative to the wavelength of your particular photon that's proportional. So you can think of the spectrum as having a whole series of lines with different delta Vs. And each one of them, the photon will eventually get into resonance with. And then, of course, and they're at some distance. T times delta V is the distance away for each of these lines. And so in a lot of transport codes, one of the approximations is called the Sobolev optical depth. And there you make the approximation that in the resonance region, the region in which a photon is in resonance with a sharp line, the physical properties do not change much. And we're fortunate to lie in that regime, in part because of the velocities and in part because of the large distances. And the Sobolev optical depth has the form where alpha is the depth of the line sort of in the local space at the center. And you divide that by the frequency of that line in the rest wavelength. And then there's this factor of CT in a so this has been moved to a homologously expanding atmosphere. So T is the time since explosion. And then there's a relativistic correction, 1 over gamma. And so when you apply this, you see that, so you get a whole bunch of lines. And the photon has to sort of march through them, and it has to pass each one. Each one is a barrier that it passes through. And you can think of its probability of escaping a line like so. And as tau becomes small, this probability goes to 1. And when tau is large, it goes to 1 over tau. And the chance of escaping or not interacting with that line becomes small. When a photon does interact, and if we assume for a moment that a photon interacting with a line scatters in a resonant fashion, it comes out at the same wavelength it went into an interaction, it will pick some random direction and then see a similar set of concentric spheres of optically thick barriers that it has to scatter through. And so this is why the photon working its way out through the gas sees the lines, and it's the number of lines that are the most important thing, because at some point it doesn't matter if you make a line stronger. It really can't do anything more to the photon than just bounce around in the line for a little while and then escape finally. So it's really the total number of lines that are above some threshold where the interaction probability is approximately 1, or the escape probability is approximately 0, that sets the sort of diffusion time or the transit time of the photon through the gas. Now, the photons really aren't in resonance scattering. When a photon is absorbed by an atom, it can re-emit. Another photon can come in and excite from that level. It can decay down to a lower level or a higher level. So the level structure actually matters. It can interact with an electron or another atom and collisionally excite or de-excite, and thus it can end up with a net heating and cooling of the gas, but that's more for the next section. So let's scatter it out and let's see what else. And so this is basically how the Monte Carlo codes work. The Monte Carlo codes take the point of view of the photon, and they follow the photon as a group of photon packets of defined energy and work their way through the supernova. So the next, well, I think you can just project this onto the board, because it's just a little outline of the fluid point of view. Let me get my little thing warm. So the next way we can think about the transport is by thinking from the point of view of the fluid. And so there we're going to talk about heating and cooling. I think I might say a little more about excitation and about solving the transport equation. So yeah, there we go. So in the fluid, from the fluid's point of view, a stream of photons coming in follows a curved trajectory. This is because the co-moving frame, as it is called, is not an inertial frame. And so straight lines are not straight anymore. It's one of those fun things you get. From the point of view of solving the transport equation, it has the advantage that the properties are the same properties you see in the lab. There, you have the rest wavelengths, you have the ionization rates, etc., etc. Things that are emitted isotropically are really emitted isotropically in the co-moving frame. So it's the frame of choice for most non-Monte Carlo transport methods for that reason. So from the fluid's point of view, so the fluid's just a ball of gas. And so you have, we'll start out with gamma rays. So you have gamma rays coming in from the decay somewhere else. And they scatter off of electrons and impart energy into the fluid. They also, the electrons have a very hard spectrum. They are a higher average energy than the thermal electrons. So they tend to have power to produce extra ionization. This is one of the components that contributes to the non-equilibrium nature of the ionization and excitation state, the non-LTE as it's called. Let's see, okay, yeah. So the non-LTE problem is extra fun. So we have a few things. Large children.
It's either that or the biologist.
So the LTE approximation, for those of you who may not be familiar, is that the ionization and the level populations within an ion can be described by the Saha-Boltzmann equation. And there are a couple of ways you can drive to LTE. The easiest way is a high collision rate with the thermal electron gas. And this will give you an ionization and excitation temperature for the atoms and ions that is identical to the electron temperature. In the supernova, we have a very low density electron background gas, so the collision rate is low. So we have low collision rate. And I can't spell. Another thing that is affecting this are the non-thermal electrons that I just mentioned, which tend to over-ionize things and excite them in interesting ways. And if you use a strong enough photon bath, you can actually drive a system to temperature just from photo equilibrium at some T black body. But we have a fairly dilute radiation field, and it departs from the black body, and it also has a different temperature, if you can ascribe a temperature or you'd like to. So TE not equal to T black body, etc. And so we're all familiar with with black bodies that aren't in equilibrium with our local gas temperature. Anytime you've ever been out in the sun, this is of course what you're experiencing. Well, outside and the sun is shining on you. If you were actually in the sun, that would be a completely different story. So, you know, outside you have a 5,800 degree radiation gas surrounding yourself and a 300 degree molecular gas, and 300 is much more comfortable. So from within this piece of, so in the general problem, and what's really happening, you have gamma rays providing a heating. You have some net heating or cooling from emission or net emission or net absorption of photons. I've discriminated by not referring to gamma rays as photons, but most of the non-gamma ray photons in the supernova are much lower in energy than gamma rays, so we can really think of them in many ways as being separate and independent. And we also have things like this will include changes in the ionization state, excitation, and changes in electron temperature, etc. So they're all sort of playing in this grand thermal pool. And you also have, of course, you have adiabatic dilution, which in general is small. In our homologously expanding atmosphere, the hydrodynamic effects are basically frozen out there. Otherwise, we really couldn't do this kind of thing. Adiabatic dilution alone would kill you if the thermonuclear event made no nickel 56. So if you just think about a million degree gas about the size of the sun and expand it to the size of the solar system, and that's about day one. And you keep going from there. When you do the spectrum problem, you make the assumption that this is zero, that these net heating terms are zero here. But like doing a quasi-static stellar evolution problem, you do allow the luminosity to grow as a function of radius from the deposition of gamma rays. So you can add gamma ray heating to affect the temperature structure. This is done in some, not all, stellar atmosphere models. So, yeah. So, and then final point of view, oh yeah, pull it down, get a little help here, is the observer's point of view. And our observers, a few of them are left. the ones who don't care about stars that collapse. Got someone right here. So from the observer's point of view, you could do the transport in the observer's frame. Photon paths are straight, but then you have to deal with the fact that you have to deal with the Doppler shifts in that way, and all of the relativistic effects. In particular, emission is not isotropic and things like that. It's another way to see that the photon would have to, traveling through your path would passing through different red, the beam of photons is passing through material with different redshifts and thus accumulating all of the effective opacity as it passes through. So for line formation, I'm going to drop to that resonant scattering approximation again, where I assume that any photon that interacts is just scattered by a line. And so this is a very simple picture, and we're going to assume some things that really aren't in the supernova. The first is a photosphere. And real supernovae don't have observers. So we have an observer over here somewhere, maybe on Earth. And so our photosphere emits a continuum that looks like that. It's a very exciting continuum. And any photon, and our atmosphere has one line. It's a resonance scattering line. And any photon that's scattered out of the beam, the photons are emitted from the photosphere, and any photon that's scattered out of the beam creates a hole in our continuum. And any photon that's scattered into our beam creates a sort of an extra piece to our flux, and they do so at the observer's tangential velocity. Velocity in the line of sight of the observer. So we can see this one here is actually negative. And if you do a little simple math, which I don't feel like doing, in velocity space, of course, surfaces of constant v tangential are planes. And because of our favorite homology law, R equals V T, they're also planes perpendicular to the line of sight to the observer in physical space as well. And so what this means for one thing is that photons that are scattered in or out of the beam at the rest wavelength of the line are in a plane that passes right through the center. And so here's a plane that has the velocity of the photosphere. This area back here in this simple picture is occulted and you cannot see it, so it makes no contribution. So the first we'll consider the effects of the absorption. So in this region you have absorption by scattering out of the beam, and that creates a small hole that starts right here at V equals zero. Lambda equals lambda naught. And it stops when you get out here at the extent of your photosphere and makes something that looks, for all intents and purposes, you know, something like that. I haven't said anything about the density of scatterers as a function of radius away from the center. And for this simple picture, we're not going to worry about that. But that is one thing that will affect line formation. Now, this whole region doesn't emit any photons by itself in the continuum, but it does scatter photons into the line of sight, photons that are taken out of beams heading towards other observers. And so there you get an emission that's centered and has its peak at the largest surface area at V equals zero. It goes all the way out to here and all the way out to here. And if I had done this with the true resonance scattering, those two areas would have to be the same, just conservation of scattered photons. And if I add, No, I'm going to have to make this a little bit weaker. I have a slightly better picture I'll put up on the screen in a moment. So you can see that on the red wing, you just get the pure emission part, and then as you move into the blue, you start to get some erosion until the absorption wins out, and so you get the P-Cygni profile. It's kind of neat. And so there's a few things that you see right away. One is that the peak in an isolated P-Cygni line is always at lambda zero. This is only a single line, though. And the minimum I don't know if there are any rules about the minimum. The minimum is almost without meaning. It depends on the density profile. There are a lot of things going on, of course, with the density. Now, if you have more than one line, let's say there's another line whose lambda 0 number 2 is over here. And so it would naturally want to, let's make it a weaker one, make some p-sigma line like that. And you can sort of add them together, though it doesn't really work that way. And these can do things like change the relative position. So blended lines tend to move these peaks. And that's why even for the most famous features in the type 1A, when you do see a peak, it's not necessarily at the rest wavelength. Now, type 2s are a little bit more cooperative. And the Balmer lines really do appear there because they're much more isolated. You also have lower velocities that reduce the amount of,
Could you give us an idea of what the density of lines were? How many overlaps are we talking about? Is there, you know, 10 of the other 10 or hundreds or thousands or?
It's really hard to tell. Yes.
Yeah, but most of them are.
Most of them.
When you have
it's the only source of emission that you have, then that doesn't matter how deep they are. Yeah.
So, if you asked a stellar observer to tell you about the sodium lines, the D lines, he would think there are two of them. The most well-defined supernova spectra never shows more than one. There is the calcium infrared triplet around 8,000 something, I think. In some type 2s, you see two features. In type 1As, you see one, if you're lucky. H and K, just past 4,000 angstroms in the blue, just to the blue of 4,000, is always two features. And in type 1As, there's a silicon line that's just a little bit further to the blue that usually shows up and blends with it. And it can actually do funny things. It makes a sort of pushes down, and then there's a little recovery, and you get little features like this at the bottom of the so-called calcium feature. And this sort of little structure down here is actually caused by a silicon 2 line that's trying to form a little bit to the blue of the calcium line. It is a mess. And the only objects where you can sort of really sort things out, I think it's like 97B or something like that. There's some low velocity type 2 spectra where they have velocities on the order of a few hundred.
How important is frequency redistribution?
Frequency redistribution.
The line scattering out is not the same.
Oh, you mean within a single line? Yeah, we don't care.
So you're saying they escape by physical diffusion, not frequency diffusion?
So unless I'm mistaken, what Frank is referring to is if you absorb a line in, say, sodium D1, and you re-emit it in sodium D1, it doesn't have to have exactly the same wavelength. So there's a redistribution over the profile. For a lot of things, we actually use somewhat artificially broad profiles anyways for numerical reasons. Yeah, the sort of you sort of put in a fake thermal profile. So now, of course, a sodium 1 line, D1 line that comes, well, actually, a sodium 1 D1 line can't come down as a different one, but re-emission in a different line, of course, is common. And that's all handled by the non-LTE terms, and in the stuff that Paolo and Daniel do, they use these fluorescence models to take care of that. Mm-hmm. So I run out of paper notes and I go back to the screen. So how do you do a model? Oh, see, there's a slightly lovelier picture, but I can't draw on this one.
It's good Bob's not here. He would remind you of Kirshner and Kwan, 1970.
No, Kazuhito is just one of my graduate school colleagues who drew this picture.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, it's right for Kirshner and
Kwan. Probably.
Just giving our time.
Probably.
Bob's not here.
Nihara's put a picture with that in the book in 72. Nihara's put a book, picture of that in the book.
Well, Swicky must come in at some level.
No doubt. No doubt. If you go to the suspect, if you go to the suspect database and you ask for a spectrum that's not there, he'll come out and tell you. It's Wiki will. So it's so this is the same picture, and again the observer is over here. And a slightly cleaner version, so it'll be on the web. So when you model a spectrum. Spectrum model is an instantaneous snapshot. We make the assumption that we make a lot of assumptions. So we need a spectrum to fit. That'd be good. So you need a spectrum, and you need some determination of the time since explosion, since we have the homologous expansion coefficient, or the age, all over our equations. We need a density structure, and this can be an exponential law, a power law, or from some hydrodynamic model. I tend to like the last one. It's limiting. Keep your parameter space down. The same thing with composition. You can take some sort of uniform composition mixed throughout the entire star. You can parameterize composition in a few different pieces. I'm doing something like that now. Or you can take a hydro model. Which is, again, wonderfully limiting. And then you need a luminosity to set the overall temperature structure. And then once you have these ingredients, then you converge your model. It's usually an iterative process. I don't know of anyone who isn't doing an iterative model. If you have a temperature structure, some of the codes don't use temperature structures at all, but most of them do now. And basically, if you've fixed the first three, you only have one knob left, and that's luminosity. So making sure you're at the right age can be a big deal.
How hard would it be to do compute media? What's involved there?
Oh boy, I have to think about that for a little while. maybe we'll talk about it later.
Okay.
So here's a fit of our most infamous model, W7, in this case 14 days prior to maximum, and this is a fit to 94D, which is very nicely observed. And I chose this plot for a reason, and it wasn't because it was clean, but here we have the spectrum, the observed spectrum, and we have on this plot three model spectra.
The observed spectrum is the solid one?
Yes. It's also the wiggliest one, the one that has noise. So we have three model spectra, and you can see them here. The middle one is the one that we think fits the best. And
is that an unmixed W7?
Oh boy. it's the only one I ever. It is stratified.
Sure.
So I don't know if there's been some smoothing applied to it. I'd have to dig back a few hundred papers to find it. This is whatever one has come out of everything in Oklahoma for years. I don't think it's changed in a long time. We used to have our own H-naught too.
Okay.
So it's most clear the quality of the fit right here in this peak around 3500. So here's the lowest luminosity model, the middle one, and then the high one, and then here's the where we're trying to hit. And if you look at a few other features, and frankly you need to see this on paper to really get the full to really make that determination, and that's what I did, you can say that the middle model is definitely the preferred model in this case. And the two models that bracketed are different by 7% in luminosity. So in our naive way of thinking, we said we can determine the luminosity given W7 and a 20-day rise time for 94D at this epoch to within about 7%. And at different epochs you get different quality to that fit. And then I did something I, frankly, that...
How does that luminosity compare with the...
Oh, you're skipping ahead. Then I did something... No, that's okay. Then I did something I thought I'd never do. I measured the distance to a galaxy. So these are lined up at all of the different epochs in which I made the fits, ranging from, I think it's what, 8 days or something like that, or 6 days, all the way out to, I thought it was 35, but maybe I dropped that one, 32. I think that's 32 or 33. And then from the synthetic spectra, we made synthetic photometry and applied a reddening correction. You always got to apply the reddening correction. And then computed distance moduli. And these are all of the distance moduli. And the individual error bars include our estimate for each epoch of our ability to measure that distance in magnitudes, and co-added with the reported observer's error, however they got theirs. And in some cases, you have multiple observations at the same epoch that do not agree. The U-band in particular is really nasty and sort of gets out of whack, as do the very late spectra. And you could see this in our late spectra, that the quality of the fit was starting to break down. And this is because the interior W7 does not look like the interior of 94D. And the U spectra, the U-band photometry, not only is there a bit of variation from telescope to telescope, that's...
Sorry, how much do you contribute to the breakdown of W7 or the breakdown of assumptions in radio transfer? That's always the question, right?
The fits were failing, so we stopped. that is the key here. And then you can see the U photometry is, or the U comparisons are fairly poor. There's very little spectra in that region, so it's hard to make the hit, and it's very sensitive to opacity as well. And this solid line here is not the average. That's a least squares fit, and what you can see from that line is it's very flat. So we don't have any trends as a function of epoch, which is good. I think if we went further, we might have problems because of W7, because of opacity issues. Some of those opacity issues might be better now or in the near future. So, measured the distance to the galaxy, reported an error bar, and it is consistent with the other known measurements of the distance. And this was done by only comparing the luminosity of the W7 model and the spectra that you got out of it to the spectra of 94D. So here's another supernova spectrum. And here the fits are a little easier to see. This uses one of Peter Hooflick's models, DD21C, a delayed detonation model.
Sorry to interrupt again.
Yeah.
You wanted to say something?
Yeah, just an additional comment. You're really hitting the luminosity as a free parameter. You're not taking the negative mass or anything.
Correct. Correct.
So in that sense, it's inconsistent with the explosion model that you use.
That's right. In you can make W7 do things it wouldn't do if it was a real explosion.
Yeah,
and that's
it's not a real explosion.
It isn't a real explosion. And so obviously to do that, you have to do a light curve calculation to sort of what would W7 be like in the sky if it was really there.
What I wanted to ask is a little bit technical. How do you quantify whether a fit is good or not?
Mm-hmm. A couple of years of training.
Okay.
The expert I fit.
Something people should really worry about. Was it a good fit or was not such a good fit? I should develop quantitative measures.
Oh, we don't disagree.
Yeah. but the point is that many people working on hot stars, for instance, are using these Bayesian approaches already. And supernova people usually don't do it.
Yeah, it's much easier on hot stars.
Yeah, sure, but it's easier.
Because your fit's closer.
Because in supernova,
you can get exactly as long as you want.
Yeah, a hot star is a relatively simple object.
Yeah, I know.
They're steady and for the most part, but yeah.
You should not try to escape from the need.
Quantity.
You won't quantify what is good fit.
Right.
Yeah,
because obviously
chi-squared will
not do.
No,
chi-squared will kill you. in part because you do something like miss the velocity
right.
On the edge here.
You know, some principles, physical principles, how those lines are formed, and you could put that at priors into your statistics.
Yeah. So the stuff that Carlos has actually been looking at the last couple of days from this from this paper by Jeffrey a couple years ago, the diff one parameter might actually be, and in fact it was designed for comparing, was it observation to observation?
They do observation to observation.
Okay. But it might also be useful for observation to theory. So this is a series of spectra for 84A. 84A is peculiar if you haven't been looking very carefully at the silicon 2 feature. It's very broad and very fast. And the reason DD21C works, at least our opinion on why it works, and W7 does not, W7 would have a distinctively slower and narrower line than this model, is that this model has a denser outer region. So outside of where the burning takes place, there's a little bit more eject out there, by I think about an order of magnitude in density, in the region where the lines are forming. And that is enough to make this line just a little bit broader. This is one of those nasty little things that are just buried in the nature of all this. Though it really doesn't get this calcium line very well. I mean, 84A has got this beautiful, broad, deep calcium line, and this model just did not fit it.
But so that means if you took W7 then, I mean, here you see there's a place where this one doesn't work. If you took W7, would it work there more likely and here? How do you make that decision? Where do you come down?
Yeah. This is where we just...
This is a very sensitive line. That's
yes.
Problem, right?
But the question is, how much do you trust in the details of the explosion model? I mean, yes, we know that it's probably not the real thing. Calcium, it's almost too sensitive to be safe.
And I want to say, calcium.
Are you willing to let that one go?
Calcium does form at high velocities. It really forms out in. This is not new calcium. This is old calcium.
And I mean, there is like all this calcium that is at high velocities, which is likely to be formed.
Or a large portion of it. So.
Yes,
the strength of this line, in a lot of ways, is not telling us about nucleosynthesis.
That's why when we try to fit sequences, spectra, we take in one light out another. We only take the density profile from a kind of standard model, name it W7, right? But then leaves the rest as parameters, because nobody would
right.
guarantee any means that the abundances, the velocities, all that of W7 have anything to do with reality. So if you really want to do fits to okay. such degree of accuracy, I think there's no way out saying, okay, maybe take the density structure as you did it here, from the hydromodel.
You take a
hydromodel. And then leave the rest, at least the composition, velocity, and all that, as three parameters, because...
Right, so this is what I had characterized as a hydrodynamically sourced yeah. density structure, and a combined with a parameterized composition.
I think this is a better way to try to get the benefits.
Well, it's a different way. It's,
yeah.
It's a forward modeling or backward modeling question.
So there's
a completely different story, and then just taking the complete model, but then it would also have to give you the luminosity, and then make a prediction. At the moment you start to say fit with a luminosity be then a free parameter, mm-hmm. and again it's not really forward. So either one of those, you say it's
so,
completely forward prediction from the model.
So clearly the.
Most of the models completely now they rely on spectra and such. And also you say, okay, I want to fit a particular supernova, but then I would think that the only reasonable assumption is to say, okay, let's take the density, because they won't vary so much from model to model. this is generic, rather insensitive to the models. But the velocity structure, the abundances, mm-hmm. the degree of mixing, and all that, it's not relative from model to model.
I don't know about your W7, but my W7 has got these nasty density spikes where the burning front is coming out, which my understanding is they are not physical and are artifacts of the hydrodynamics and the resolution of the hydrodynamics. So in many ways, if you took a exponential fit, which works remarkably well with W7, and used that as your W7, that would be in a lot of ways preferable. So you've actually switched to a parameterized density structure as well, but as you were saying before, that's okay.
Yeah. No, but in any case,
I know. No.
It becomes more crucial in the nebular phase than in this early phase.
Yeah. So clearly, with hydro models, the way to go in the is high quality light curves, and that is a light curve is really just a sequence of spectra, and a light curve model is really a time-dependent stellar atmospheres problem. However, most of the light, there are three sort of basic ways that people are doing light curves now, or could do light curves. I'm not sure anyone's actually done this yet. I've been claiming I'm going to do this for almost a decade, and I don't think anyone's beat me to it yet. There are multi-group rad hydro codes. This is what most of them are. There are Monte Carlo type codes, and this Monte Carlo is a really nice idea, because with the Monte Carlo, you go back to the photon point of view. You know, what's the light curve? It's just the sum of all the photons that are escaping, and how far does a photon progress through the atmosphere? Well, if you have a time delta t, it travels c delta t, and so it makes all of those little length segment jumps as it's bouncing around. Now, there are issues involved, like how do you control the thermal structure, and how do you deal with deep trapping, where a photon is bouncing around thousands and thousands of times to sort of spinning your computer and making it hot and not giving a whole lot of results. I mean, that is essentially the biggest problem with Monte Carlo methods.
Now that the models are all 3D, I think Monte Carlo is the only way to go. Okay.
Probably.
You can do the transfer, multi-coupler, or whatever in 3D, which don't have any source.
So the sort of traditional way is multi-group rad hydro. These are related to codes that do a lot of other things. The rad hydro part of it, the sort of, I can't remember what my next slide is. So in a multi-group rad hydro code, you break the spectrum up into pieces. It might be 10 pieces, it might be 1,000 pieces. And in each piece, you create a mean opacity. For relatively slow-moving gases, you can do like a Rosalind mean, you know, which, if I remember right, is weighted over the Planck function. Okay. And then you have the opacity in each one of these bins, and you solve the rad hydro equations for multi-groups. I think the last time I really looked at this, at the end of the century, the typical resolutions were on the order of about 100, a few trending towards 1,000 groups. If this feels inadequate to you, we have been recently making upgrades to our neutrino transport code so that we can handle in the memory allotted 20 groups for our state-of-the-art runs. So fortunately, neutrinos don't have to worry about line opacity. Which, yeah, but that's just some more fun. You just have blocking factors everywhere. It's all in there. So you can't use standard Rosalind mean or other mean opacities. You have to use these so-called expansion opacities. And the expansion opacities are an attempt to account for the extra effective resistance of the radiation to flowing through the fluid caused by hitting all of these lines. I'm not a big fan. But this is essentially what most of them do. There's also like the gray code that Wolfgang mentioned, where they use a very simple approximation for the opacity that's roughly right. And that gives you light curves that are decent. I discovered over the weekend, I was reading a paper by Hager and Woosley and Hager, and that the Kepler code that they use for the thermal bomb, or is it piston models, I can't remember, nucleosynthesis and explosions in 1D massive stars. I hesitate to call them core collapse, because their cores don't actually collapse. They don't simulate that part. They actually have a light curve mode where they use a gray opacity that is like the one that Wolfgang talked about. And they can make, you know, relatively, okay, so I guess we're done. So, yeah, so I'll say just a few more things about the, so effectively at time, I thought I had another plot, but.
Might be on the next
one. No, that's the end. That's the end. So apparently I didn't put this one in. So there are really three things that contribute to making, that you need to extend a stellar atmosphere into a time-dependent stellar atmosphere, or that you could put in. One of them is solving the time-dependent transport equation. This is largely putting in the DIDT term. Unless you have radiation fronts, this probably doesn't matter. These types of terms in their moment versions are in the rad hydro codes. The second thing you can put in is a time-dependent ionization excitation, or a time-dependent non-LTE. This may actually matter. There's a number of reasons to think so. I suspect, but I haven't obviously proved it, that some of those issues with the calcium lines may be related to that. The calcium lines form out in regions which are otherwise optically thin, and they are in expanding gases. And so you can effectively freeze out the ionization level. In all of the models that we run, we either imply a temperature structure or we converge a temperature structure. And the converged temperature structure out in the optically thin region is going to be cooler than it might be. Of course, there's the competing effect of adiabatic expansion. So it's one of those things that needs to be calculated. So I think this is worth looking at. Luc Desart has done something recently where he's included time-dependent non-LTE in a very approximate way by taking snapshot spectra, not making a real light curve, but taking time snapshot spectra. And then he allows the non-LTE at time, 42 days to be affected by 40 days. So he includes it in that way. And he sees effects, and I think they're real and certainly worth investigating. Nikolai Chugai has talked about the excitation of the Balmer lines in 87A as a ionization freeze-out effect for a long time. There is an alternative explanation, but I will not emphasize. And finally, of course, the time dependence of the thermal structure, which is the most important part. And I swear I had that. Maybe I don't know how to use this program. Okay, it's in there. If I hit escape, I can find the slide because it's right. Oh, yeah, it's right there. I must have skipped past it. Okay. So these are the three ingredients I was mentioning. If you leave out the thermal evolution, it's not a light curve. So now we can go to the blank page. And I'm finished. Do we have any additional questions?